This is tape number RH-265 of the Ways and Praise Tape Library by Rick Howard.
Which I have not had to put up with one like this for a long time, so it's very interesting, and we'll see how far we can go. And also, of course, this is our last time, and what I thought I'd try to do for you is to give you some vignettes throughout the rest of the book, just to introduce you to this section. And I was talking with Dean. We do have a complete set of Revelation tapes. When we taught the book of Revelation before here in the church, we took about a year to do it. And so we have that set, and he's going to check out quality of those tapes. And if they're fairly decent, then we'll bring that series up to date. So any of you that would like to get tapes on the closing chapters, for example, that we have not had time to deal with. I want you to turn with me, to begin with, to the 13th chapter, and let me just review the first section a bit, and then we'll get into the second section. We have here the definite rising of the beast coming out of the sea, and this, of course, is the personhood of this satanic figure that is described in the Word of God by a number of different names, about 14 names, I guess, 13 or 14 names that are used to describe him: King of Babylon, Lucifer, Son of Morning, the Assyrian, the Little Horn, and so forth, of Daniel chapter 9. And the imagery of his coming forth is basically that he is a political amalgamation of concepts, kingdom, imperial concepts that have been in the world from the beginning of time, which are represented by the various descriptions, leopard and bear and lion and dragon and so forth. And he is described as having horns, certain number of horns. Again, 10 being the figure that is most often used, 10 suggesting a combination of powers that would reproduce the Roman Empire. Now, I've suggested this to you before, and we'll see this in the next picture in the 13th chapter, which is really where we ended. This is just by way of review. But the basic concept is that the seventh kingdom that arises in this description, and then in the next description it says out of the seventh comes an eighth, which indicates that the seventh kingdom is this effort to revive the Holy Roman Empire, or the Roman Empire, which maybe, as I suggested to you in closing last time, could very well be this common market situation. This fits in so perfectly to the detail. Now, again, I'm not saying that in any kind of dogmatism, and I'm not suggesting that is absolutely so. But I think that you need to be aware that when these, what we do see at least is the possibility of these things quickly assuming that kind of dimension. Basically, the national structure of the common market is almost identical to the Roman Empire. There's a few problems. There's one nation in it now that shouldn't be there, will probably drop out. There's a couple nations yet to come into it to complete the number accurately. And the common market, as you know, is in a state of flux. Several nations have voted themselves in and then had a referendum and voted themselves out. And one nation is being held out by the other nations at this point, namely Britain, at least in its complete acceptance. So it's in a state of flux. But what I want you to see by this is that would be the seventh world power that is described here, the seventh horn. And then in just a few moments, when we describe the false prophet, it says the seventh becomes an eighth, or an eighth merges out of the seventh. What we would have then is the actual Antichrist's kingdom coming out of this this revived Roman Empire. For example, what we could see in a kind of prophetic sense is, let's say the common market was the thing, that the common market would basically become an operating entity That they would erase national barriers, they would establish a common monetary system, all these things that are already being talked about. And then a charismatic leader, and I'm using charismatic in a different sense than spiritual charismatic, but a real charismatic leader would rise up and be accepted. Now the suggestion is that he would have to subdue. He would rise up from one of the 10 powers that make up this seventh power. Do you get that connection? I mean, this is where we get confused somewhat, because what the Bible describes is this kind of seven world powers that have expressed this kind of imperialism, going back again, and I named them, including Assyria and Babylon and so forth. The last one would be, and it's very clearly the one that is, was the Roman Empire that was in existence when Revelation was written. Then the seventh would be this effort to revive the Roman Empire. Now, I told you last time when we talked about this that it's not, you don't have to be looking at this from some biblical viewpoint, whether or not you hold to the pre-tribulation viewpoint that I've been talking about or not. The simple fact is historically true is that there has always been on the scene someone who's wanted to restore the Roman Empire. And that's gone from Charlemagne to Napoleon and Mussolini and all of these others that have had this great image. Hitler himself had this great image and desire. Now, when this Roman Empire is restored, it will be a combination, according to what I read, it will be a combination of 10 separate nations. I don't know if I have the right numbers there, but 10 separate nations. Now, the further suggestion in this chapter is that one of the rulers of these 10 nations, in other words, it will be an amalgamation to begin with, or a cooperation, kind of a United States of Europe, and that's what they're already calling the common market. The United States of Europe is a name that's being used. But what is said is that one of these men will subdue two other nations. And that's where the one horn defeats two of the other horns. So what happens is there's evidently going to be an actual kind of merging of three of these nations in an actual political sense. And then, of course, the other 10 will operate together. When that occurs is when we have what is spoken of in the next chapter, that this seventh power will become an eighth. And it's interesting because the Greek there makes it very clear that it's not an eighth that is separate, but it's an eighth that comes out of the seventh. In other words, the Greek construction makes that very clear. So we see this beast then is being described in a kind of duality in the 13th chapter, and this is what you must not be confused by. Just recognize it, that in one sense you're describing the leader, and in another sense you're describing the political power that's connected with it. Because really, of course, in this chapter or in this entire book, we're really interested in seeing these world forces that are being kind of allayed one against the other. And this beast, of course, is going to continue, this power is going to continue for 42 months, according to verse 6. He blasphemes and makes war against the saints and all those whose names are not written in the book of life and so forth. Then we go into the 11th verse of the 13th chapter, and we get the second member of this satanic trinity described. And notice he is described as an other beast. Now this is a very interesting thing because there are two Greek words for another. One of the Greek words for another means another which is different from the first. For example, say I had purchased a ballpoint pen or something, and it was no good. And I went back to the dealer and said, I want another pen. Obviously, what I mean is I want a different pen. This one doesn't work. But if I had found a pen, in fact, I just recently did discover a pen that I really like. It's one of these new floating head pens, and I really enjoy it. And say I would go back and I would say to the person, I want to buy a gift for a friend. I want another pen. Meaning I want one exactly like this. I want to give this to a friend and I want it to be exactly like this. That's the word that's used here. In other words, this is another beast, but it's used exactly in the same way that Jesus said when he said, I'm going to go away from you, but I will send you another comforter. Again, the same Greek word. Another like unto me, you see. Not another meaning separated from, but another exactly alike. He comes up out of the earth in verse 11, chapter 13. And remember, the earth is a symbol of Israel. He has two horns, which are like unto a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. Here are two concepts that are very much like the Lord Jesus. Of course, the lamb quality is one you recognize. That's the universal symbol. In fact, throughout the book of Revelation, he is the Lamb of God. But notice that this lamb has the sound of a beast. This is an almost occult vision, isn't it? It's the vision of a gentle lamb, an externally a beautiful and acceptable symbol of religious truth. But when it speaks with this roar, you see. And so the whole thing is, again, notice and know that John is describing these things in images that will be very real to you. So what do you get? You get a picture of deception, don't you? You get a picture of a wolf wrapped up in sheep's clothing that when it really reveals its character is that of the dragon. It's that of the beast. It's that of Satan. And yet its external appearance is that of the lamb. And of course, the obvious connection here is we're talking about religion. And we're talking about a deceptive religion. He exercises authority of the first beast in his sight. He maketh the earth to worship. And there you get the very key, of course, in verse number 13. And he causes the death stroke to be healed. Now this phrase is interesting. And here again is a duality of interpretation. First of all, one of the interpretations is, of course, that the death stroke that is healed refers to the revival of the Roman Empire. In other words, having been dead, it is raised again. But there are a lot of scholars who are now, and I am one of them, I'm not a scholar, but I am one of them who hold this opinion. There are a lot of us who believe that there is something else being said here. And this comes out of a tendency to look at the nature of the emphasis upon the miracles that this second beast will do. Now, what could well, let me give you a scenario here. Let's just stop a moment and let me give you a scenario that I think will help you understand what I'm meaning. Let's say that this Holy Roman Empire is revived in the name of the United States of Europe. Let's take that as a case in point. A certain charismatic leader arises from one of those nations. Let's say that the charismatic leader arises from the nation of Belgium itself. And he shortly subdues two other of the smaller nations around him. Perhaps two of the northern nations like Sweden or Denmark. Let's say Denmark and Sweden. So that you have Brussels, Denmark, and Sweden being spoken of as actually merging politically and the other nations being run. He's brilliant. He is a combination of John F. Kennedy and Henry Kissinger and Jimmy Carter all rolled up into one. He is outstanding to the degree that he merges this United States of Europe into such a strong power that literally he, in an economic way, he defeats communism. In fact, he so strongly merges this political strength and an economic strength, the United States of Europe, that the United States of Europe just rises above any other of the nations of the world, and the rest of the nations of the world are standing back all agog because of this man. Well, what do you know about such a leader? One, to be such a leader, he would create tremendous enemies. And what I believe in the scenario that I see is that he is killed. And he is killed by being shot in the head, specifically. The description is pretty obvious. the word uses the concept of the sword. He has a wound of the sword in his head, but I think the word sword there really is describing a means of death that was familiar, a military means of death. I believe it would probably be rifle. Right, what happens then? He lies in state. The world sees him, just as, of course, you know what happens today. The funeral of John F. Kennedy, one of the earliest uses of satellite, was known around the world. Today, of course, any leader that would kill immediately would be known everywhere, especially a world-renowned leader. What then happens here, I believe, is that there is a satanic resurrection. And this charismatic leader is brought back to life. And that is the miracle that turns the attention of the world that we will read here in a few verses. Now, when that happens, what in essence happens, as far as I'm concerned, is when that leader is, quote, resurrected, it is not him. It is Satan incarnate in the body of this charismatic leader. And the things that occur from that point on evidence this final satanic splurge that goes on from this point. Now, that's the scenario that I would suggest to you as what is happening. The other suggestion, of course, is that the wound being described is the miraculous way that this dead empire is put back together. But notice, it is in this second beast that we're talking about, this definitely religious beast, this one who rises up out of Israel, if you accept the earth as the symbol. And again, we have an even better description concerning this false prophet in the book of Daniel, in which it says, it gives very specific descriptions about him coming from Israel and not holding to the worship of the God of his fathers, and all those other phrases in Daniel chapter 9 that are so very prolific. So he does great signs, verse 13. He even makes fire to come out of heaven. Remember, that was Elijah's sign. Now remember that Elijah, if Elijah and Moses were the two witnesses we've talked about, Elijah and Moses are now dead, aren't they? Because they were killed as a first act of this first beast coming out. In other words, the first manifestation of this beast that we have described coming out of the sea, is his first act is to kill the witnesses. And of course, so they're dead. But this new spiritual leader, what does he do? He immediately repeats the miracle that was identified with this dead witness. Of course, the dead witness was also raised in the sight of the people and has gone on. So you see, what he is doing is identifying himself with a true move of the Spirit. Now, obviously, things are going to be very confusing at this point. The witnesses had witnessed for 3.5 years. They had withheld rain. They had told the truth. 144,000 confirmed Jewish witnesses had been preaching the gospel. All these awful things had been happening in the world. Suddenly, these witnesses are slain. The people rejoice because these witnesses have brought such suffering upon them. They lay dead. The resurrection comes. The voice speaks out of heaven, and they rise. And in the sight of the whole world, they miraculously go to heaven or go into the heavens. Obviously, then, this new counterfeit religion, this new counterfeit prophet, must immediately establish his credentials. And so he does. Of course, he calls down fire from heaven. He heals, notice that, he heals the death stroke of the first beast. He causes the world to worship the first beast. He heals the death stroke. That's in verse 12 and 13. And then he deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by reason of signs given to him in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast who hath the stroke of the sword and lived. There again is the very specific description that this beast had the stroke of the sword and lived. And it was given unto him to give breath to the image. Now, this isn't the beast. See, he causes an image of the beast to be made. Now, this is obviously the same thing that Daniel said would happen, that in the midst of his covenant with the Jewish people, the Antichrist would break his covenant, cause his own image to be set in the holy place, and to be worshipped as God. Now, Daniel had said that thousands of years before, and he called it the abomination of desolation. And when Jesus was on earth, he divided all of his teaching about future events or eschatology, he divided it in the 24th chapter of Matthew, in the 15th verse, he divided it with that event. In other words, that event in which the Antichrist shows his true colors and sets up his image in the temple, that's the event that's going to divide and begin the last 3.5 years, or the very final breath of the world's kingdoms and of the world's efforts anti-Christ. So you see, this image that's being spoken of here is that event, the event Jesus called the abomination of desolations, and the event Daniel described in his term. And of course, again, I would just suggest to you that it is probably the miraculous resurrection of the beast that leads to this worship. In other words, something else must have happened to have given this beast, or to have given this charismatic leader, a super spiritual image in the eyes of people. In other words, he is made as God, practically. In fact, Daniel said he would cause himself to be worshipped as God. And in order for that to have happened, of course, there must have been this miraculous intervention that we've described. And of course, he causeth also the small and great, rich and poor, free and bond. And I like that phrase just to tell you, my friend, that there's really no difference between us in this world. And it's going to be an amazing thing that in this hour, how the word describes, and several times in the future chapters we'll see the same thing, the division between those who have money and those who don't in the world that's coming is going to be nothing. In other words, money is not going to be able to buy a change. You're not going to be able to buy protection or security with money. Because this world system is going to be so totally devastated that it'll be an entirely new system of value. But he causes them to take a mark on their right hand or forehead. No man can buy or sell, save that he hath the mark, even the name of the beast and the number. And he that hath wisdom, let him understand that the number of the beast is the number of a man, 666. Now, we made some general comments on this. Remember that this is a false phylactery. The Jews had a phylactery in which on their foreheads and on their wrists they wore that acknowledgement that there is no God but the Lord. And it is more than just coincidence that this whole satanic thing is, you know, it's almost like Satan has read the scriptures and has just taken everything of significance and tried to duplicate, including the Trinity, the resurrection, the phylactery that separates the Jew. Everything that is God is duplicated, including, of course, the idea of the Ark of the Covenant and the Holy of Holies. Instead of the Ark of the Covenant, the beast puts his own image there, which speaks supernaturally. Here's an image that speaks and gives words. Can you imagine all of the kind of attraction that this is to the average man? I mean, you think today, the average person who finds it difficult to believe in anything spiritual, in fact, we're in a very interesting world. The greatest money-making films on the market today have to do with the occult. The film The Omen, which I've talked to you about before, has already grossed $70 million in the first year that it was on the market. It is the greatest money-making film that Hollywood has ever produced. It has already outgrossed Jaws and other related films. There are two Omen the Seconds coming out, already in production. In addition to that, there have been a half a dozen non-approved substitutes for The Omen. One of them had just opened in San Francisco last week, called The Sentinel. Now, all of these have to do with the subject of the Antichrist, the Mark of the Beast, satanic involvement in our world power. In fact, I remember I went to see The Omen. In fact, I saw Jaws the first time Jaws was out. I think I saw it about the first week it was out. And I, of course, you know, it was a lot of fun for me, although I've got to admit to you that I think everybody in the theater, when the shark attacked, everybody in the theater pulled their feet up. It was just an automatic reaction. In fact, it was both humorous and when I first saw the film Jaws, I knew, because of course I enjoy the technical aspects of filming, and I'm very much into media and think that the church needs to be a lot more in the media than it is. And I knew something was done, and I couldn't figure out what was done. I sat there through that film twice trying to figure out why I was so involved with it before I discovered, I read a technical article, that they had developed a way to actually sync the microphone with the swimmer so that when the swimmer was in the water, you had the sense of being in the water. Psychologically, they put you in the water with it. Well, what the film Jaws did for sharks, the film The Omen did for dogs, because in the film The Omen, of course, the dogs are all demon-possessed, you know, and Gordon and I went to see it together, and when we came home after seeing it and went in the house, Sam suddenly looked very suspicious to both of us. But Sam is my dog, incidentally, in case you wonder. We sat there kind of watching him out of the corner of our eye. Of course, the tragedy of this whole thing, you know, a believer can look at this with some degree of humor, but the tragedy is that what really is happening in all this in the world is that Satan is more acknowledged as a source of power in most people's mind today than God is. In fact, I've talked to university students who have said to me, I don't know about God, but I know there's a devil. See, I know they have established that there's a power source here, a satanic occult power source. And so that the world is ready for this. I guess that's what I want you to see, that we are establishing a world attitude that is very ready to accept these kinds of lying wonders, these kinds of duplications of spiritual truth. And of course, that's exactly what we have. So we've been introduced then to these two. Now, let me just comment about 666 and what it is. It's interesting, of course, throughout history, men have worked trying to tell what 666 is. And when I taught Revelation at Bethany Bible College last semester, I had students working on various reports, and three of my students did a report on the Antichrist, and they went through an elaborate deal, and they started out showing how you could use 666 and make different people's names to fit. And they started with this very elaborate deal showing a person's name, and of course what they did, they ended up showing that my name could be 666, you know, which was got them all failures in the class. But the truth is that, of course, you can play all kinds of number games. People have played these games with Henry Kissinger and with Nero and various Caesars, and it was done with Mussolini. It's been done with a lot of people. But what is basically here is that 666 is the number of man in the scripture, or 6 is the number of man, and of course 666 is a multiple of that number, which is a number of it's an incomplete number. The number of Christ is 8. The number of Christ is completion, octave, the new. And I remember reading a funny story once that Bach's children, when Bach would go upstairs and try to lie down in the afternoon, that his children would be playing during their practicing, and they would hit a diminished chord and just leave it there. Bang, and get up. And of course, Bach could not stand it, and he'd have to get out of bed and come down and complete the chord, because it was, you know, if you've ever been a musician, you know what it was to have this incompleted chord hanging in the air, you know. And Bach couldn't sleep, and he'd have to get up and come down and finish the chord before he could go to sleep. Well, that's really a part of the image that's being made here with this number. That the whole Antichrist system is going to be this effort to duplicate, and yet because it is of man, it is incomplete. It is a harangue and an effort to be spiritual, but it is incomplete. Now in the 14th chapter we go on to another, there are seven events that are announced in this chapter, and I want you to look carefully with me to these seven events as we move through them. First of all, the first event announced in this, he says, I looked and I saw the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him were the 144,000, having his name and the name of the Father written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of... And no man could learn the song Save the 144,000, even they which had been purchased out of the earth. And these were they which were not defiled with women, for they were virgins. These are they that follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were purchased from among men to be the first fruits unto God and unto the Lamb, and in their mouth was found no lie, and they're without blemish. Now, several obvious things about this. Number one, you must obviously see that these people are learning to sing the new song. And we have already described in the fifth chapter of this book and the ninth verse, the church having been raptured, singing the new song. So now this is a very clear word here. But the 144,000, and by the way, the word is that these are they who were saved from where? From out of the earth. Again, the earth is a consistent scriptural symbol for Israel. And the consistency of it throughout Old Testament and New Testament, and especially throughout the book of Revelation, is amazing. In fact, if you just take each of the phrases where it's used, you get a very clear picture, probably even concerning the judgments that are being made. But notice this. These ones who are learning to sing this new song, they who had been purchased out of the earth, also have some further designations. They have not been defiled with women, we are told, or not been defiled with women, for they are virgins. Now, this really means that they have been purified from any kinds of satanic defects. In fact, even a great Roman Catholic scholar, Abbot Crampton, who wrote hundreds of years ago, he said it this way: the women with which they were not defiled are the impious doctrines and the guilty lasciviousness which is symbolized in the apocalypse itself by Jezebel and the great whore. And you will see that, we'll be getting onto this in just a few moments, how the whole satanic religion is represented as an obnoxious, obscene whore who causes the world to be spun and to be captivated by her whoredom and to drink of the cup of her iniquity. These have not been defiled, and there is no lie found in them. And it's interesting, that phrase is almost like what we found about the three who were in the fiery furnace. No smell of the furnace was upon them. It's almost that same picture. In other words, they lived in this awful hour of satanic deception when everything that could be done to duplicate miracles and even to duplicate Christ himself has been done, and the deceivers riding forth in every counterfeit manner imaginable. But they were not deceived. I wish I had a whole evening to study with you the symbolism of Mount Zion. I can just suggest to you it's probably the most beautiful symbolism in the Bible. It's the most inspiring symbol in the Bible. The first mention of Mount Zion, of course, is when David comes and conquers Jerusalem from the Jebusites. And Mount Zion is the place he establishes his capital. And Mount Zion is always connected with David. You see. And the promises of the Messiah is that the Messiah will rule on the throne of his father David. Now, in no way has that happened up till now. The Messiah Jesus has come and has been born and suffered and died, which is the description that Isaiah saw, that would precede his reign and his rule. But just as sure as those prophecies were hidden in the writings of Isaiah, just as sure as that are the multitude of prophecies that say Jesus shall reign from the throne of his father David. And this picture of Mount Zion, of course, Mount Zion is such a marvelous place, not only because David there established his rule, but you know that Mount Zion is also where David brought the ark. The Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of God's presence, which for 100 years was in a barn 8 miles outside of Jerusalem, since having been lost to the Philistines in the Battle of Achish. And then brought back, and you know, it was a tragedy among the Jews who opened it and were killed by the thousands in plagues, and so they just dumped it in the barn. It had been cared for there by first the son of the man who owned the barn, and then others. Who were set aside over the years, but for 100 years it had been there. You remember David, hungering after God, tried to bring it back, and he tried it the wrong way, and King Uzzah was killed as a result of David's stupidity in trying to bring the ark back by man's way. And finally, after he pouted a little bit, and God spoke to him, he went back to the Word and saw the way the ark was to be brought back, and he brought it back with great rejoicing. You remember the story, he danced before the Lord. And of course, Michael, his wife, who was a sign, incidentally, of the Carmel Church, Michael, his wife, would not have anything to do with his dancing and his emotionalism, and she rebuked him publicly. And David did a very brave thing. David was so committed to the worship of the Lord that he put away his wife. Now God, first of all, of course, said she would be barren as a result of what she's done. She will be barren. She will not bear. And of course, the carnal church will never bear fruit. But David made the choice of going on spiritually in spite of the effect of the and the despair of Michael. So Mount Zion has so many images. I'd love for you to just take a concordance sometime. And it's not hard. Most of you in your Bibles, you don't have a complete concordance, but most of you have at least a partial concordance in the back. And look up Mount Zion and just start reading Psalm 20 and Psalm 48 and Psalm 74 and Psalm 76 and Psalm 92 and Psalm 102 and 149 and 110. 30 different psalms talk about Mount Zion in addition to Micah 4 and Isaiah 2 and on and on and on these passages. So what is being said here? Chapter 14 is saying in its first kind of event is the identity of the Lamb standing with those on Mount Zion who were standing for truth in the middle of this deception. The second picture we're giving in the sixth verse is another angel having eternal good tidings to proclaim to them that dwell on the earth and unto every nation and tribe and tongue and people. For he saith, fear God, give him glory, for the hour of his judgments is come. Worship him that made heaven, earth, and sea, and the fountains of the waters. In other words, again, this is a call to the finality of this judgment. Thirdly is a second angel, and he describes Babylon. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the great, that hath made all the nations to drink of the wine and wrath of her fornication. Now, we're going to take a whole chapter talking about her as she falls. And we're going to take a whole chapter talking about her in her four manifestations, the mystery of Babylon. But here is just a proclamation. Again, this is that kind of parenthesis saying, she's fallen, good news has come. It's that future kind of view. The fourth word here, fourth vision, is another angel, a third one, which followed, saying, if any man worship the beast in his image and receive the mark in his forehead, he shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, prepared on mixed in the cup of anger, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lord and of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day and night, and they that worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints, they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus Christ. Now here then is that awesome word of warning to those that are upon the earth, that by receiving the mark of this beast, they have damned themselves for eternity from the presence of God. Now notice this phrase, forever and ever. It's the same phrase I've talked about before. It means unto the ages of the ages. It is used 12 times in this book of Revelation. 8 times it's used concerning the reign of Christ and the glory of Christ. 3 times it's used concerning punishment. But it's the same phrase. So that the same phrase that speaks about how long his reign shall be in eternity is the same phrase that speaks about how long shall be the suffering of those who have gone their own direction and not accepted the word and revelation of the Lord. And of course, it's going to be a great trial time, you see. An immense time of trial for those that are upon the earth. For in not to receive the number of the beast will be to die horribly, unprovided for, without food, without able to make purchases, and of course the persecution and the martyrdom that accompanies it. But there will be many who will choose to do that, we know, because we've already seen those who have been slain because of not accepting this testimony. Now the fifth vision is given in verse 13. A voice from heaven saying, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, they may rest from their labors, and their works will follow them. Notice it again, my friend. Here is what I have just said. Those who are on the earth, but who refuse this deceptive thing of
satanic deception and who pay in their own blood rather than to take the awful course of iniquity. And I saw, and behold, there was a white cloud, and on the cloud I saw one sitting like the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a great voice, saying to him on the cloud, send forth thy sickle and reap, for the hour to reap is come. The harvest of the earth is ripe. And he that sat on the cloud cast his sickle upon the earth, and the earth was reaped. Of course, the cloud here is the cloud of Shekinah glory. There are many descriptions of that. The Lord appeared in the cloud. We were told he would come in that manner, in that kind of appearing. And here, of course, is to begin now the pouring out of those seven vials. That's what's mentioned. This is the first harvest vision for those of you who are taking the special designations. This is the first harvest vision that is mentioned. There are three of them. Between chapters 14, 15, and 16. And you would compare this to Matthew chapter 13, where Jesus speaks about the wheat and tares being harvested together. The second vision then in verses 17 to 20, this is an angel again coming out of the temple. Notice the source of the judgment is the righteousness of God again. He has a sharp sickle, hath power over fire. And he calls with a great voice to him that hath the sharp sickle, saying, send forth the sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. Now listen carefully, please, friends. The angel cast the sickle to the earth and gathered the vintage of the earth and cast it to the winepress, the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden without the city, and there came out blood from the winepress, even unto the bridles of the horses, as far as 1,600 furlongs. Now that demands some discussion. First of all, what is a furlong? A furlong is roughly in English, feet. It's about 606 3/4 English feet. Each furlong is about 606 almost 607 feet. In those days, a mile was composed of, it was short 142 yards of what our mile would be today. So what's being talked about here in an English equivalent is about 200 miles. That's the picture. It's less than 142 yards with each mile. So, but it'd be 197 miles, something like that, 198 miles. Now that's a very interesting thing. And I want to talk to you just a moment about this, even though this is jumping ahead of the picture. Again, you remember how this book is written. We get a parenthetical view in which we get a future view, then we plow through the chapters and we see the literal fulfillment of that. So what we're having in this chapter, you see, this is a chapter that's seeing the Lamb on Mount Zion, the final wine press and so forth. It's all kind of in these seven pictures are the pictures of everything that's going to happen that we'll get a extensive view of. But this particular view is very interesting because in Israel, if you were to follow from what is called Har Megiddo in the north of Palestine, which is, of course, where we get the English word is Armageddon, but Har Megiddo means the Mount of Megiddo. Har is the word for mount. Going down this valley, which is often called by various names, Jezreel and so forth, the Valley of Jehoshaphat is another name that's given to the lower. Jehoshaphat is the lower section of the same valley. But this valley, it's the Jordan River Valley, and it runs on through the Dead Sea, and it runs all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba, to the port of Elah, on the Gulf of Aqaba,
And this valley is exactly 200 miles long. And when we are given the description of the battle that ends this whole thing, the final battle, you see, we're given four pictures. We're given, in a few moments, we're going to look at the picture of religious Babylon being destroyed. Then we're going to see commercial Babylon being destroyed. Then we're going to see political Babylon being destroyed, which is the Battle of Armageddon. And then we see the Satanic Trinity themselves cast into the lake of fire. So that there is a four-stage judgment, you see. But this particular final part of it is described in this area, that when God tramps out what is called the grapes of wrath, the winepress of God's wrath, that the blood will, and the Greek there suggests not run to the horse's bridle, but splash to the horse's bridle. That's the picture that's given. And that it will splash to the horse's bridle throughout this whole period of time. Now, what do we know about the Battle of Armageddon? We know that there will be an army from the east that will number, and we've already been introduced to it, it will number 200 million men. In addition to this, will come the great army of the Antichrist and his forces. And these that have been enemies, and there will also be the fourth force from the north, the revived force from the north, so that the nations of the world will be called into this arena. And the description of the arena that's given here, and I would suggest you read, for example, in Zechariah chapter 2, and in Joel chapter 3, and in Revelations chapter 19. Those are the three passages where you have the Battle of Armageddon described, in essence. And it is described as a fearful thing. Here, it's just a picture that's given to you. It's the seventh little picture that's dropped. And in the seventh picture, we're just told that when that wine press comes, it'll be in this kind of an area, 1,600 furlongs long, and the blood will go to the horse's bridle. So you see, when we end this 14th chapter, we have actually in the 14th chapter and 15th chapter, we are just given this kind of pre-final picture. In fact, let's go on to the 15th very quickly so you can see what I'm talking about. In the 15th chapter, it begins by saying, I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels with seven plagues, which are the last. For in them is finished the wrath of God. Interestingly enough, that's the Greek word tetelestai. That's the same word Jesus used on the cross, and it's a legal term. And what it means is the penalty has been paid in full. When God has finally poured out these seven bowls, that's it. And I saw, as it were, the sea of glass mingled with fire. Now, what was the sea of glass, friends? You remember, we saw it at the beginning. It was like the laver, wasn't it? But it was what was in the throne of God, and the church was standing on it, weren't they? But now what's the difference with it? That laver, which represents the grace of God, the mercy of God, the cleansing of God, the sanctification of God, upon which the believer stands, now it is mingled with fire, you see. This is the very final moment. Them that come off victorious from the beast and from his image and from the number of his name stand by the sea of glass, having harps. And again, what are they singing? Very interesting, isn't it? Those who have come out of having victory over the beast, they're standing by the sea of glass, they're singing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, because they've just learned how to sing the new song, you see, in the last chapter. Great and marvelous are thy works, O Lord God, the Almighty, righteous and true are thy ways, thou King of all. Who shall not fear, O Lord, and glorify thy name, for thou art holy. All the nations shall come and worship before thee, for thy righteous acts have been made manifest. I told you the book of Revelation is a book of songs, isn't it? Everywhere you turn, there's songs in the book of Revelation. Praise to our God. And after these things, I saw the temple, the tabernacle, opened. Here again, judgment coming from that place. And here come the seven angels with seven plagues. arrayed with precious stones, pure, bright, and girt about their breast with golden girdles. And one of the four living creatures gave unto the seven angels seven golden bowls. Now the word bowl here means kind of a saucer-like, not a deep bowl, but the kind that they put the incense in the tabernacle. Just really, if you can imagine more of a saucer than a bowl, you'll understand what it looked like. Full of the wrath of God who liveth forever and ever, the temple was filled with the smoke of the glory of God and from his power, and none was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels should be finished. That phrase, none able to enter, has always been interesting to me. It suggests to me the grief of God. You can see in it whatever you do, but I see in it that even God, in this moment in which judgment is necessary, is so grieved that none can enter until the final plague is over. In fact, the amazing thing of this book, have you noticed how many times in the midst of all the judgments that God backs up and an angel comes and says, you know, repent or worship God because he's worthy? And how many times even the plagues have been an effort on God's part to get the people to turn, and yet we found the phrases, yet they repented not of their sorceries, they repented not of their murders, even in the mercies of God in this incredible manner. So, again, all of these have been pictures that we've seen. Now we go into the 16th chapter. We begin with this most interesting view, because in the 16th chapter now, we're going to be introduced to this whole final judgment upon the satanic system. A great voice of the temple saying to the seven angels, go and pour out the seven bowls of the wrath. And the first one, and poured out his bowl upon the earth. And what did it become? Look at this, friend. It became a noisome, grievous sore upon the men that had the mark of the beast and that worshipped his image. First of all, you know that the sixth plague that Moses brought upon the Egyptians was a sore. And you know also that in Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 27 through 35, that this is mentioned. But I cannot help but think that almost every time nuclear holocaust is described, it is described in terms of the horrible, unquenchable sores that come with nuclear attack. And all of you have been exposed to pictures in Life magazine when it was in existence and other places of those awful nuclear sores that come with this kind of thing. And the sea pours out, the second poured out his bowl into the earth, and it became blood, as of a dead man. What a phrase. What a phrase that is. Not just blood, but blood as of a dead man, and every living soul died that were of things that were in the sea. Have you ever been near water where animals, where fish have died for any poisoning reason? Boy, I used to live near Lake Erie. And Lake Erie, we'd go there with summers. Toward the end of the time I was growing up as a boy, of course, Lake Erie abounded with industries. And that's before ecology was much of an issue. And boy, some of those places, those plants, would let loose some kind of foul chemical in the lake. And you'd go to the lake and it would just literally, up against the shore, would just be covered with dead fish. They're just floating on, either on the beach or floating on the water. It's a putrefying smell. Can you imagine what happens when it goes like this? As someone suggested, there'd doubtlessly be a run on Coca-Cola, to say the least. And then verse 4 says, the third poured his bowl into the rivers and fountains of the waters, and it became blood. Now you notice the difference between sea here and rivers and fountains of water. It became blood. And I heard the angel of the water saying, that's an interesting phrase. Did you know there was a messenger in charge of the waters? I heard the angel of the water saying, righteous art thou. Righteous art thou who art and who wast. See, a future reference is totally unnecessary. Thou holy one, because thou didst judge. They poured out the blood of saints and prophets, and blood hast thou given them to drink. They are worthy. And I heard the altar saying, yea, Lord, the Almighty, true and righteous are thy judgments. Wow.
What a vision that is. Now, one thing I want you to know, you know, the thing that I mentioned Sunday morning, in the 12th chapter when we studied about the woman of Revelation 12, it says that the earth fought for her. The earth swallowed up the waters that the Antichrist sent out against the woman. And something most believers don't seem to understand is that the earth is on God's side. The creation is on God's side. It's under bondage now. But it's God's earth. And when it comes to fleeing and running and what's going to happen in this day, the earth is going to begin to free itself. And it is going to begin to act independently on behalf of God and of his people. Well, that's an exciting thing. It just causes shivers to run up and down my spine. You know, so many believers that I talk to today are in a great period of concern about all of these things. And I've already said to you, one of the damning things, I think, of this teaching about tribulation, the church going through tribulation, I think there are two damning things about it. Number one is that it seems to me that the church, when it has been tribulated, has, under external tribulation, has never been aware of it. That God has always so divinely provided for the church in that hour that it's been its greatest victories, its most glorious times. I had the privilege of going through the catacombs in Rome. And I went through catacombs that were not, there's one set of catacombs, of course it's very commercial, but I went through the set of catacombs that is very few people get to go through. It's through a monastery, a Roman Catholic monastery in Rome, and only select people are allowed there, and it's maintained exactly, you just go down, you can only go at certain hours of the day and so forth because of the light factor. It was one of the most precious experiences. I wept openly and unashamedly. And I know some. This is going to seem to some of you, I suppose, as being kind of ghoulish. But I, on several occasions, just reached my hand in where skeletons of believers were just, they had to bury them with such haste, just thrust them into these cavities and threw the mud over the hastily opened areas. And I just thrust my hand in there a couple times, feeling that sense of vibration and connection with those who had gone before. But the catacombs are filled with praise. Every message. And they're written with symbols. The symbols abound, of course. That's one thing I need to watch myself getting on a lot of other subjects. But one thing that I personally think about Pentecostals is that we have very little appreciation for architecture and symbolism. And I hope when we come to build our new church by faith that we're not going to just put up something that just is utilitarian, but that will speak for some of these things. Because the early church beautifully identify the symbols, and the symbols of the grape leaves and the symbols of the anchor. The anchor was one of the most precious symbols to them. And just